Good morning, it is 11 a.m. on Friday, November 14th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In this episode, we'll kick off with two stories from City Council's last meeting, including the return of the Child Safety Zones debate and how the city plans to make Kingston more business-friendly. Dive into Bylaw University student and alumni perspectives on Homecoming 2025, and cover more community stories from across Kingston. After the motion was withdrawn at their last meeting, Council revisited Councillor Connie Glenn's proposal to establish child safety zones in Kingston. The original motion asked staff to recommend amendments to the city's Parks Bylaw and Community Standards Bylaw to create child safety zones, also known as sensitive use zones, within 50 meters of playgrounds, schools, daycares, splash pads, and children's sports fields. These zones would prohibit temporary shelters, the possession or use of drug paraphernalia, and open-air drug use in those areas. That motion was pulled after fellow councillors raised concerns about the ability to enforce additional measures and legal risk, especially concerning whether such restrictions could conflict with existing court orders around sheltering in public spaces. Taking that feedback, Glenn brought the motion back, this time with a different direction for staff. The revised motion asked staff to return with a legal opinion outlining the risks and limitations of passing bylaws that prohibit high-risk activities, such as erecting shelter, using or displaying drug paraphernalia, or consuming illegal substances within defined child safety zones, possible measures to reduce those risks, including alternatives for addressing encampments in public spaces, and how much of these prohibitions are already covered or restricted by existing federal, provincial, or municipal law. With this, staff would also provide options for council, either bylaw amendments or other approaches that could improve protection from high-risk activities within child safety zones. Delegation spoke before council, offering perspectives both for and against the new direction. Kingston residents Kevin Smith and Melissa Reed said the following before council.
I have lived experience with homelessness and have seen this issue firsthand. I've walked through parks and public spaces and seen things no child or even adult should have to see. This motion represents balance, keeping our parks and playgrounds safe for children, while also showing understanding towards those who are struggling. Kingston has the opportunity to set an example for other cities by doing both.
Where's the infrastructure? Where's the consultation? Where's the trauma-informed service hub that should have preceded this motion? We wouldn't want people in the city to think that we lacked creative imagination. And yet here we are, debating a motion with no solutions, no new solutions, no new infrastructure, and no new vision for the people that live here.
Glenn made her case, emphasizing balance and the need to prevent children's exposure to high-risk activities.
I'm hoping that what my colleagues will see is that I took to heart their concerns. So this motion right now is about coming back with opinions and options and about continuing this conversation. Because the rights of one group shouldn't outweigh the rights of another. We have an opportunity to start to stem the tide. We know that exposure at an early age to these things is something that triggers it. Public health is invested, and our entire community, for that matter, is invested in, you know, basically controlling adverse childhood exposures and impacts. And so through those programs, we're working on that. So I'd like to ask my colleagues to join me in helping to explore the options for continued conversation about how we can balance the rights of both children and the others in our community to make this a broader conversation about opioid and drug use, which isn't just in the homeless population, but amongst the entire population of Kingston, unfortunately. And how we can work together to ensure safety in playgrounds, which should be joyful, fun places for our children to grow, learn, and explore.
However, some councillors were still hesitant. Councillor Ryan Boehm voiced multiple concerns, particularly around rights, enforceability, and the risk of pitting vulnerable groups against one another.
We can have all these rules, but it's the enforcement aspect that we're always going to struggle with. So whether it's 15 meters, 50 meters, or 500 meters, the whole thing here is we're really ultimately, and this is where I really struggle with it, is we're pitting two vulnerable populations against each other. I have five kids. I definitely want them to be safe in parks. I want them to be able to play and not step on, you know, broken glass and stuff like that. But I also have to be cognizant that the people that are part of the other vulnerable population that we're talking about don't have the supports needed to break away from that life. So there's a whole systematic breakdown here. And I'm just not sure that we're approaching this the right way. I just don't know how you're going to apply this. Short of somebody doing open drug use in a park, which I'm pretty sure is already illegal. I just don't actually think this is actually really going to do anything at the end of the day. I think this is just, it's like a little bit of grandstanding where we say we're doing something, but are we actually really doing anything effective?
Others, like counselors Brandon Tozzo and Gregory Ridge, argued that simply gathering information posed no harm, and that council needed clarity before making any decisions.
We're not going to solve a mental health and addiction issue around this horseshoe. The crisis of mental health and addictions, like I think we had staff do a budget of how much it would cost to solve it. I think it's somewhere in the ballpark of $500 million. We're going to move the dial a bit in one direction or a bit in another. And that's, I think, where we can do. We can try to make our communities a bit better and a bit safer. More information is always better. If there's a legal opinion on anything further we can do, I have no problem going back to our legal team and getting that information and then making decisions based on that.
I think everybody wants children to be safe, and we're struggling with a number of pieces around enforcement. And I get a lot of feedback from parents in my community about that, certainly. I am happy to support this motion simply because of the question that was raised by Councillor Bum about enforcement, right? So if we can get more clear legal opinions on what enforcement methods are available when they are necessary.
Mayor Brian Patterson introduced an amendment to the motion, expanding the scope to include other public spaces beyond those listed by Councillor Glenn.
So when we're asking for a legal opinion on the risks and limitations about, you know, creating these child safety zones, including within a specified distance of public playgrounds, schools, splash pads, and children's sports fields, I've just would propose that we also add the wording "and other public places." The reason for that is that the children don't just go to public playgrounds and they don't just go to schools and splash pads and sports fields. Children also walk down the sidewalk. Children also go downtown. Children also go to other public places along with adults. In fact, some of the biggest concerns that I have faced are not just what some families and kids have encountered in public parks, but also even just walking down the street. I had one father and daughter who came right into City Hall and talked about what they had seen happen just right out in the square behind this this building. So I think that I think we should look at it. Again, other cities have done this, so I don't think it's unreasonable to look at this approach. But I do think expanding just to add other public places, again, would just broaden the discussion just to say, should we be looking at any other places, public places as well?
This amendment was well supported by those already in favor of the motion, and councillors who had hesitated said this broadened the discussion and prevented the issue from targeting specific groups.
To me, this is just a consideration about getting as much information as possible and seeing what more can be done. This doesn't necessarily, to me, show that we're planning on moving forward with any plan of action. But what Councillor Bohm did say earlier about the enforcement piece, I think this gives it a broader scope and it allows councillors to have additional information.
I actually can support this amendment, and I think it actually increases the scope of this to just create a safe city for all and doesn't pit people against each other. If it's safe for children to be kind of everywhere, well, then by virtue of that, it's safe for all of us to be there. So with this amendment, I could support the original motion. So I do hope that it passes. I think it actually broadens the discussion and really doesn't pit one vulnerable group against another the way the previous, without this amendment, the motion can kind of be sort of contrived.
Glenn accepted the amendment while clarifying that her goal was still to focus specifically on providing additional protections for youth.
So I'll let it go through if people are going to support it, because we are not at the point of making a decision about what we're doing. I do want to increase safety throughout the community, but so many of the other things that we need to do to improve safety are around mental health, addiction supports, housing, all of those things. But right now, I think our children deserve a little extra protection, which is why there was specific wording.
With the amendment, the motion carried with a vote of 12-1, with Councillor Shaves being the sole vote opposed.
So I'm hoping that we will see some options and opportunities to improve the situation for children and youth, and to make sure that they move ahead unburdened by addiction issues, that they get the supports they need. And I know that we will all continue to advocate for the mental health and addiction supports that the rest of the vulnerable community needs. And hopefully we will see both national and provincial responses. I think they're dearly needed. We're all struggling with this issue. But I'm grateful that what we're going to be doing is responding to the concerns of our community in a thoughtful and legitimate way, letting them know that we are trying to find a way forward. It is not easy, and this is not about trying to polarize the community. It is about saying, what else can we do with the powers that we do have available to us?
Staff will analyze these spaces both in their totality and individually and return to council with a legal opinion and options for moving forward. At their last meeting, council unanimously approved a motion focused on making Kingston a more business-friendly city in response to input from the local business community and his experience as a small business owner. Councillor Jimmy Hassan introduced the motion aimed at preventing costly delays and making it easier for new and existing businesses to navigate municipal requirements. The motion directs staff to find ways to streamline licensing and approval processes and improve coordination between departments like building and fire services.
The city of Kingston is struggling to become a most business-friendly city. Its unnecessary delay sometimes is a financial burden and is personal stress for the investors, especially from the small business owners. As a small business owner, I understand the complication of extra the financial burden on the business. And unnecessary delay is also become a financial burden on them. And I hope that council will support this and we will see the report how we can make our city, the process for the building and the licensing, more people's friendly and business friendly so we can attract more investment to our city.
The motion notes that global economic challenges, including tariffs and other pressures, continue to affect local businesses. Councillor Gregory Ridge, who seconded the motion, said this review is an important opportunity to look at how the city can play its part in supporting Kingston's business community.
This is a very important opportunity that we need to take to revisit and look at process, and especially with our current economic environment, to see what we can do to support small business owners, medium-sized business owners, and reduce administrative burden where we can, when possible. And so I hope that everyone is in support of this motion. Again, not people, process.
The motion received unanimous support from fellow councillors. Councillor Vincent Chinani said he hears about these obstacles frequently from his constituents.
I've had multiple people approach me about a lot of these issues and obstacles that they've encountered trying to open their business or expand their business or even change their business, even a slight way. I've had one who came to me and then they were told one thing and then they opened their business and then they tried to verify and then all of a sudden all these other things happen and then they have to, okay, now you have to pay for this and then they're no longer in compliance and then they have to pay a fee, like a fine. But they tried to do it the right way by trying to, start. And I'm not saying it's anybody's fault, but streamlining processes, making the process better and smoother would really go a long way. This is something that I've heard a lot about and concerns, or even the people are confused. They're not sure what they need to do, but hopefully I'm I've got a lot of good hope on this, that it'll actually make things better and smoother for people wanting to do great things in our community. You know, we want to be welcoming. And I keep hearing from people saying, you know, it's a lot easier to do things in Napanee. You know, they're a lot more welcoming, you know, so I want that for us also, you know, so.
Under the motion, staff will review licensing and approval processes and report back to council with an information report in the first quarter of 2026, detailing the findings, recommended improvements, and any changes already underway. This work will be in partnership with Kingston Economic Development, the Chamber of Commerce, Tourism Kingston, and other partners. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report today featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, November 14th, we're going to have the holdover from that Thursday squall, some trace amounts of freezing rain, once again, less than 1 millimeter in terms of accumulation, and that'll be in the morning before warming up a little bit and clearing into the afternoon. Saturday, November 15th, daytime high of 3 degrees, mix of sun and cloud. Sunday, November 16th, daytime high of 5 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation in the forecast, dropping down to 1 overnight. And then starting off next week, Monday, November 17th, daytime high of 5, a mostly cloudy day here in the city of Kingston. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Reminder that the LaSalle Causeway will be closed on November 16th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., so that's closed for all vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians to allow for temporary opening of the main marine navigation channel. Please be advised of the following road closures for the Remembrance Day ceremonies. Bagot Street, Barry 2 West, 10 to 11 a.m. Barry Street, King to Stewart, 10:20 a.m. to 12 p.m. King Street, Barry 2 West, 10:20 a.m. to 12 p.m. King Street, Lower University to Barry, 8:15 a.m. to 12 p.m. And Ontario Street, Barry to West, 11 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. Here are some relevant road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed for construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess 2 Mac is closed for construction activity and staging at 484 Albert. Barry Street, Queen to Colborne closed for construction activity at 283 Queen. Earl Street, Collingwood 2 Toronto closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. King Street, Tragically Hip Way to Place d'Armes closed November 12th at 8 p.m. to November 14th at 8 a.m. for event-related parking and storage at Slush Puppy Place. Kings Court Avenue, concession to First, closed until November 21st for gas main installation by Utilities Kingston. Raglan Road, Division Domain, closed until November 30th from 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. each day for a gas main installation. Toronto Street, Durham to Park, closed until November 28th for installation of new water, sanitary, and storm services. And Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work.
Thanks, Jesse, and he'll be right back on the mic this weekend calling what could be a historic matchup for the Queens Gaels. After capturing their first Yates Cup in 16 years, Queens travels to Saskatoon this weekend to face the Saskatchewan Huskies in the 2025 Mitchell Bowl, with a spot in the Vanier Cup on the line. Queens is undefeated on the road this season, and here's a bit of history for you. No Ontario team has ever beaten a Western opponent on their home turf in a national semifinal since Queens did it way back in 1968. Could this be the year they do it again? Tune in to CFRC at 3:15 p.m. Saturday to find out. Once again, Jesse will have the call live from Saskatoon. Queen's University has officially joined the Canadian Blood Service's first ever Fall Get-Together campaign, a nationwide challenge uniting 106 colleges and universities to help Canada reach a major milestone, 1 million active blood and plasma donors in the next 5 years. Canadian Blood Services is a vital lifeline for many Canadians, supporting blood, plasma, stem cell, organ, and tissue donations across the country. Between now and December 31st, students are encouraged to give together by booking group donation appointments at local donor centers.
each campus competes for the highest donor point average, with top schools earning limited edition hoodies and a Friendsgiving banquet. Debbie Barfoot with Canadian Blood Services sat down with CFRC to share more about this new initiative and the Queen's Campus Challenge.
This fall, we're launching the Fall Get Together, which is a national donor challenge that celebrates the power of giving together. We're speaking directly to groups, friends, families, colleagues, classmates, teammates, programs, and inviting them to book and donate together. The Campus Challenge works that at all post-secondary school environments across Canada, we're encouraging campuses to set up a team if they're not already registered in the Partners for Life program, and then to add members to that team and make a group donation together. So points are accumulated through your membership numbers and the group donations that the campus does together. Across the board, all across Canada, we're seeing many schools get involved and many new schools get involved. So that's important. That's the whole purpose of the campaign, is to engage people to get involved with the campus and donate blood so they can assist and support patients all across Canada who need blood and blood products to maintain and live a healthy lifestyle.
While this challenge is a first for post-secondary schools across Canada, Barfoot says Queen's is no stranger to supporting the cause, with a long-standing history of student donors and blood drives on campus.
So Queen's University has been involved in our Partners for Life program since inception. Queen's set up a national partnership team over 25 years ago. And it was developed and started by some nursing students at Queen's. Throughout the years, we have a very active club on campus called Queen's University Blood Team, which is QUBT for short. They raised awareness about the need for people to join the stem cell registry and to donate blood. They organize group donations. We have on-campus blood drives that they support and volunteer at. For this campaign, the campaign results only display nationally the top 10. And at this point, Queen's is not on the top 10. So I'm putting the challenge out there.
As Barfoot mentioned, there's still work to be done, both at Queen's and across the country, to reach CBS's goal of 1 million new donors in the next 5 years.
Obviously, as the population increases, so does the need for blood and blood products. With that comes a need for blood donors to support to ensure that the demand is met. The demand is met through hospital patients, people that require surgeries. We need to increase our national donor base to 1 million over the next 5 years. People might fall out of the blood system for numerous reasons. So we always need to replenish. And this is especially important for the younger. So minimum age is 17 to donate blood. So we encourage our youth to get out and learn more about donating blood, check their eligibility, and then join this challenge and the national campaign, as well as the Queen's University Blood Team.
And she adds, joining as a team is one of the best ways to make an impact.
More than a third of Canadians under the age of 35 who have donated blood before have done so as part of a group. So it's a great way for a group to get together and give together. Also, it can be less intimidating if you're a first-time blood donor to go with a group of friends, fellow students, or colleagues, so you can donate together and go through the experience first time as a team. It's a cool way to get together and understand that you are really giving back to fellow Canadians.
Queen students can take part in the Fall Get Together campaign by booking group donations or taking part in the next on-campus event on Monday, November 17th, running from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the BioSci atrium.
I would encourage every student to first go online to blood.ca. Take the eligibility quiz, make sure that you are eligible to donate. We have a fantastic website that goes through the parameters, the criteria, and explains the need for blood and blood products. Once they determine if they are eligible, to reach out to the Queen's University blood team, join one of their upcoming group donations because they have many in the books, and we have on-campus blood drives happening at Queen's in November. So if they join the National Fall Campaign Campus Challenge and then join the Queen's University blood team and book an appointment, their donation will be counted towards this challenge.
Once again, that was Debbie Barfoot with Canadian Blood Services on this year's first ever Fall Get Together campaign. To learn more and book a group donation, you can head to blood.ca. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie. After an uncharacteristically quiet few weeks in the University District, the University District Safety Initiative has now been lifted, marking an end to what is typically the fall party season. Homecoming, FOCO, and Hallow Weekend all passed without much fanfare, prompting mixed reactions. For Bylaw and Kingston Police, the weekends were considered a success. Dan Hazel, supervisor of enforcement with the city, had this to say.
I'm really happy to report back to the community and the Queens community that this year's homecoming, the official weekend, was a very successful event. Very quiet on the enforcement end. There was really no hotspots of concern throughout the entire weekend. It was exceptionally quiet. It was nice to see the alumni back to our community. The oldest coat I saw was a 1972 alumni. Had a quick discussion on him, and it was really nice to see them come back to the community. For the second weekend, we did issue 13 penalty notices under the Administrative Monetary Penalties Bylaw, which is a very low number comparison to the last previous years. So I would say that the second weekend was also successful. I think from my side of the table, I just want to give a huge thank you to all of our community partners, the Queen's community, Queen's University, Kingston Police, the police liaison teams, and to the enforcement officers that were all on duty for the event to make it as safe as possible.
Hazel attributed the success to the work done leading up to the weekend, particularly improved communication and outreach with students.
I think the main factors right now is the communication ahead of the events. Exceptional coordination amongst the Queen's University community, the AMS, the Kingston Police, and bylaw enforcement, really just to identify the areas or times that we might need it, using social media posts and getting the information out to the public on what the University Safety District Initiative is. All those efforts seem to be trending as a community in the right direction. And it seems that the events are now becoming less and less enforcement-based and more community-oriented, which we're very happy to see. So I suspect for the future, into the next years, we could continue with those models, with the ultimate goal of having these events go off and no community safety concerns.
However, the biggest conversation among students and alumni wasn't about enforcement. It was about timing. Students and alumni continue to express frustration that homecoming has been scheduled during reading week in recent years, saying the shift has made it difficult for current students and returning grads to connect. Queen's undergraduate student Hannah Harrison voiced that feeling in a video posted on TikTok.
I think Queen's is absolutely diabolical for always making our HOCO on a day when it's our reading week and none of the students are here, and here's why. So yesterday, I was visiting a family member who it was their 20th reunion from graduating from Queen's. We were at the Queen's pub, and I went to the bar to get a drink, and there was a guy there who's got to be at least 85 years old. Okay, he graduated in like 1960. Okay, so do the math. And he's looking around, he looks kind of sad, and I was like, oh, hi, sir, like, are you all right? Are you looking for someone? And he goes, well, I'm looking for the students. Where are the students? And I said, well, it's our reading week. Like, nobody's really here. And he goes, that makes me so sad because what I look forward to the most about coming back to Queens is seeing all of you being so happy and having fun with your friends and reminding me of the best time of my life. So after my heart broke a little, I thought about it. And honestly, the whole point of Queens making homecoming on our reading week is so that we don't drink and party too much. Well, we just do it the next weekend anyway, so it literally changes nothing for us. However, it ruins the experience for the alumni who want to come back here and party like they're 20 again.
That sentiment has been echoed across social media by students and alumni alike, with many alumni saying they plan to include it in their feedback to the university. When asked about the scheduling choice, Queens responded in a written statement, quote, the event took place on the third weekend of October, consistent with past years. Students continue to play an important role through volunteerism within their faculties and by supporting events.
helping to create a welcoming experience for returning graduates, end quote. The university also noted that this year marks one of the highest attended homecoming weekends in recent years, reflecting a steady increase in alumni engagement over the past 3 years. Looking ahead, the 2026 dates are set for October 16th to 18th, once again landing at the tail end of Reading Week. Before we wrap up this morning, we're going to run through your Friday forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer this weekend. Tonight on Friday, November 14th, catch I Take Your Hand in Mine at the Kingston Grand Theater at 7:30 p.m. or warm up those vocal cords for karaoke at the Buckle starting at 9 p.m. For live music lovers, there's plenty to choose from. Happy Hour TGIF kicks things off at 4 at the RCHA. Hawksley Workman hits the Broom Factory at 7 p.m. And Steve Strongman and Kim Pollard bring the blues to the Grand Theater at 7:30. Later on, Gerald McGrath plays Tiernanog at 9 p.m. And Patter takes the stage at the Toucan at 10:30 p.m. Saturday, November 15th brings the Kingston Public Market downtown from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., plus holiday shopping at the Kingston Secondary School Bazaar and South Alley Market in Gananoque. Music highlights include Rhea May at the Broom Factory at 7:30 p.m. and Barrel House at the RCHA at 8 p.m., and Jelly Train closing out the night at the Toucan. On Sunday, November 16th, start your day at the Memorial Center Farmers Market from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., and check out Igniting the Imagination at the Grand at 10:30, or Billy Goat's Gruff and Other Tales at 3:30. And for a mellow finish, Will Turnbull and Logan Brown play Spearhead Brewery at 2, and Eric and Megan perform at the Cove Inn starting at 5. Looking ahead to Monday, November 17th, the Queen's Swing Dance hosts a fundraiser for Trellis HIV and Community Care at Wallace Hall, starting at 6:45 p.m. And Michael K. Myers and Rick Flanagan kick off the evening at the RCHA at 4:30 p.m. Once again, those are just a few events happening around town this weekend. You can check out CFRC's full concert and events calendars at cfrc.ca. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.